Why'd you do it?
I didn't, since you ask.
You gonna fit right in. Everybody in here is innocent. You know that?
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective's look at the film adaptations of different seasons. Part of Percolated Media's Stephen King Retrospective series.
I'm sorry. It's just that I've heard all of these stories before.
Join Garrett.
The colossal prick even managed to sound magnanimous.
Matt.
Why do they call you that?
Maybe it's because I'm Irish.
And Adam.
I guess I just miss my friend.
As they continue going through the popular author's cinematic interpretations of his work by reviewing the three films adapted from one of King's most well-regarded collection of stories.
I'm never going to get out of this town, am I, Gory? Do anything you want, man. Yeah, sure.
Included in this series are 1994's The Shawshank Redemption.
In 1966, Andy Dufresne escaped from Shawshank Prison.
1998's Apt Pupil.
Do you ever wonder why people do the things they do?
And 1986's Stand By Me.
Sleeper hold, sleeper hold!
Yeah, but I'm serious!
No one gets out of the sleeper hold!
Keep coming back, podcast listeners, as we will continue going through all of Stephen King's adapted works in publication order.
Thank you for the most enchanting evening.
Are you guys ready to talk about a dead body?
A snacko.
The Percolated Media Different Seasons series begins now.
I find I'm so excited I can barely sit still to hold a thought in my head.
Apt Pupil was released October 23rd, 1998. Budget on this was $14 million. Box office, $8.9 million. Ouch. And this was directed by Bryan Singer. You know, guys, it's really hard to think about now, but there was a period of time when Bryan Singer was a really sought-after, coveted director. He was on top of a lot of people's lists to be the next big director. So he had his choice of projects to do. Right after Usual Suspects came out, what did he do? He turned down The Devil's Own. He turned down The Truman Show. He needed to do Apt Pupil because he read it when he was 19 years old and felt he needed to do it.
Yeah, he also turned down Alien 4, which would have been certainly the biggest production he had done at that point. But apparently this is something he really wanted to do, and he had enough cachet with Usual Suspects to basically have his pick of what he wanted. He could take whatever projects he wanted to direct. You know, everyone talks about Usual Suspects and everyone thinks, oh, X-Men was the next thing he made. No, this is right in between both of them. And it's kind of an important movie. I don't think you get one of the casting decisions in X-Men without this movie, on top of several other things. But my question is about the book or the novella. What was the inspiration for King writing this particular story?
He's never come out and said. This was put right after, as we've done these podcasts, in order that they are in that book. It was placed right after Shawshank Redemption. Apparently, he wrote it in between drafts of The Shining to tell you the way his mind was working at that time, whereas Shawshank Redemption was written in between drafts of Salem's Lot. So when it was time for Different Seasons to come out, he placed this right after Shawshank. And you know what? I did reread it this week. And you know, I'll say this. I think it's pretty morally bankrupt on King's part, a lot of parts of that book. Also, it is so hard to adapt because there are parts of it that Singer doesn't even touch base on that we'll get to. And even though there are no creatures, there's no rabid dog here, there are no vampires. Matt, it's one of the scariest things he's ever written, in my eyes.
It's one of the angriest things he's ever written. Like, clearly, he was not in a good place, or he had some feelings about the world that he wanted to just get out in the open. And unfortunately, it's one of the books, much like Rage and a couple of other ones he's written, where implications in the book went beyond just implications. Like, there are, the way that the novella ends is significantly altered, and unfortunately, the way it's originally written, stuff like it happened in real life not too long after the movie, of all things. And on top of the production, which we'll certainly get into, there's a lot of dirty laundry with not just this movie, but this novella. And it's also not just angry, but in that series, the different seasons, Shawshank, very hopeful, Breathing Method, some hope at the end based on what happens. Stand By Me, there's some bitterness, or The Body, there's some bitterness, but that story is also about like moving on to a degree. This one is the biggest outlier because it's not happy, it's not uplifting in any way. Doesn't give you any sense of hope. If anything, it gives you nothing but pessimism for the future. So it's just a weird inclusion in that story because it doesn't quite fit with the other three.
Now, I am the King fan of the trio here. I did not see this in theaters. However, the third on this podcast, Matt, did see this in theaters. Adam, I'm assuming you went to theaters to see this based on the name Bryan Singer.
I went to see this based on a few things. Bryan Singer, huge. The subject matter fascinated me. Not in a, ooh, this looks hopeful and happy kind of way, but I love studying history. And the initial trailers made me think that that's kind of was a dark look at somebody trying to look at that kind of thing. And that, especially in high school, this was a little afterwards, but that was me kind of delving into and reading some books that I probably never should have without a little bit better supervision. But I felt like if there was someone in my neighborhood, I would have been knocking on that door to get information because I just absorbed that kind of just that shit. So this was made for someone like me to go see based on the trailer I saw. Creepy as that is.
Did you know it was based on a Stephen King novella before you went?
God, no.
You didn't.
Had no idea.
No clue.
It does feel weird to me because from what I understand, different season, like all the other ones are really about a passage of time and they use breaks to kind of show different seasons and different lengths and span years. And at least in the movie, this one doesn't really do that. And I don't know if the story does in the book, but this one seems time-wise to be a lot shorter spanning than the others.
Okay.
Well, that's one of the big alterations in the translation is that the novella takes place over several years.
Yeah,
He starts as a freshman and it goes through a season.
Oh God, that makes more sense.
Yeah. It's significantly more truncated as far as like the timeline we're led to follow.
He did that because he wanted to concentrate more on the relationship between McKellen and Renfro than go over how crazy Renfro's going in the course of the film. Because if you read the book, Todd in the book, throughout the course of talking to Dusander, eventually just goes absolutely crazy. And you're reading about him having nightmares. There are scenes in the book where he is raping the girl in this with Dusander egging him on as a nightmare. And while Todd does have nightmares in the movie as well, he goes way deep in that, almost to the point where it's almost a Nightmare on Elm Street, the way he uses nightmares in that story. And as Matt mentioned, it is a very pessimistic story. There is not too much happiness that happens. In fact, I'll go ahead and reveal this right now. The ending is very altered to the point where, Adam, do you know how the book ends?
Looked it up after this watch to find out, so yes.
Okay. Basically what happens throughout the course of the book is Schwimmer's character of Edward French does find out about the fact that Dusander is not his grandfather. So when he approaches Todd on it, Todd eventually just shoots him cold blood, then takes a sniper rifle, goes up by a freeway in a tree, and just starts taking people out left and right. The very end of the book is so haunting because it just says that it took 4 hours for him to go down. I mean, that is dark. I don't know. Matt, do you think that ending could have worked in this movie?
No. I don't think there's a chance in hell a studio would let that decision be made. Because also, one of the big changes in the book, he kills a lot of people.
Yes.
He's a serial killer. Yeah, he becomes a full serial killer. And that in this, it's really only one person you see him kill. And even then, he's not the full instigator. So that's a big change as far as like the context of this adaptation. Which, long before Bryan Singer was ever attached to this, was going to be made.
Okay. You keep jumping to things I was just about ready to get into. All right, let's get to that. So,
I know, much like Dusander, I know how your mind works.
Different Seasons is released in 1982. So around in 1984, it was optioned by a producer we have talked about with King in the past, a producer by the name of Richard Kobritz. He produced the Salem's Lot miniseries. So he had optioned it, and they went through a couple actors to play Dusander. They went to James Mason. They went to Richard Burton. But both those actors ended up dying, and they ended up going to Nicole Williamson, which, Matt, you and I have reviewed him. He was in Exorcist 3.
Well, It's so funny because Nicole Williamson's in Exorcist 3, Richard Burton's in Exorcist 2.
Yeah.
And James Mason was in Salem's Lot.
Nicole Williamson was also in Excalibur. So he's here. Also, there was a pretty big show in the mid-80s, a show by the name of Silver Spoons. They had gotten Rick Schroeder to be the Todd character in this movie. He was 17 years old at the time. They cast him in it. They were full on in production, and then they got 40 minutes in. They got 40 minutes of footage, and then they ran out of money. So they tried getting funds to complete it. By the time they did, Rick Schroeder had already aged out for the role, and they never finished it. So King, by the mid-90s, had sued to get the rights back. Cut to Bryan Singer wanting to do this movie. This is before Usual Suspects had come out. He goes to King, and he wants the rights to this story. Singer also sent a portion of the script that he had written with his friend, Brandon Boyce, who's also the credit writer of this, along with a cut of The Usual Suspects, as it hadn't been released yet. King liked it, and he went ahead and optioned the rights for $1, as he did back then. And that's when the movie, they finally went going on production. And again, Matt, he could have made anything. Why did he go to this?
Well, listening to him, it sounds like this has been a passion project for a while. And you got to look at the 90s, like King had gone back in vogue. And in particular, some of his films were, I don't want to say Oscar bait, but they were tremendously successful in the awards circuit. Misery, Shawshank Redemption. I mean, Shawshank went 0-7, but it got a lot of the staying power, as we talked about last week, from just being nominated. We'd have The Green Mile the year after this. You had Dolores Claiborne. All those movies have little to no supernatural. The Green Mile does, but it's not a horror movie. So I could see in Singer's mind wanting to do this because it also had not been previously adapted. And also, you didn't have to do a lot of, you know, supernatural horror. You could steep the horror in reality. And unfortunately, he took that literally in a lot of ways.
All right. Let's address that elephant in this room and then just not go back to it for the rest of this podcast. Because as you guys know, I don't like talking about these things. But we got to do it because the stigma around this film.
Also, yeah, because this is, for the record, everybody, all the stories you hear about Bryan Singer, some of them strictly allegations. The genesis is from this production.
Yes.
By all accounts, Usual Suspects, there was nothing reported, but this movie, there's something kind of infamous that maybe a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah. Like I said, Bryan Singer was very sought after before the production of this movie, but it was during this movie that those stories started to come out. And the stories that started with this is he's filming a shower scene in this movie that is still in the movie. We'll talk about everything surrounding the story of it when we get to it, a story in the book. And in the course of that, we have two boys, 16 and 17 years old. There was also a 14-year-old boy there. And they claim trauma from the experience of being told to get naked when they didn't really want to. Now, whoever you talk to, it's either been settled out of court or they were paid. And they never did go to court. So no real criminal charges have been filed. Nothing has been official. But the stigma around that and the parties that were going on when I was living in Hollywood and I would talk about with a filmmaker friend of mine all the fucking time, I believe it. Matt, what about you?
I think there's too much evidence to believe the contrary. There's too much of a paper trail. There's too many stories. You know, it's one thing if it's one experience and you have one person that's clearly looking to make money off of misfortune and that kind of thing. But when you have a rap sheet of allegations as blatant as what Bryan Singer has, and like I said, allegations for the most part, because there's a lot of things that have not gone to court. But given a lot of what we know and a lot of the people he was friends with at the time, one of which we talked about with Masters of the Universe, of all things. Again, we don't connect these things on purpose, people. It just happens, I promise. But regardless, if you're asking me, like, what do I believe? I think there's unfortunately some clear negligence, and I think there's there's a pedophile trail. You have to completely have your head in the sand to look at this as anything, look at strictly as face value. I think that's just being blissfully ignorant.
And in watching this movie this time, guys, I have to say, in paying attention to how he films Brad Renfro in this movie, whether he's waking up in a cold sweat in bed.
I was going to mention this when we got into the movie, but there's too many instances where it's shot in a way that like Michael Bay would shoot women.
Yeah.
In a borderline pornographic way. And it's uncomfortable because of what we know with these stories and also the fact that Brad Renfro was, what, 14 when he made this?
14.
And I want to talk about Brad Renfro for a second. It's also sad that we have a movie about institutional corruption starring someone who was arguably corrupted by the Hollywood system in and of itself and the excess that he got from it. Now, ultimately, he made his own decisions that led to his passing, but it's one of these things where there's so much art reflecting reality intentionally and not, that I was not looking forward to watching this. I have to be very transparent and say that, because whenever we talk about, like, with X-Men, we kind of had to bury the lead, so to speak, because there wasn't a lot of, like, stuff from that production. But when you look at Brad Renfro, Sean Ashmore, the guy who played Pyro in X2, you look at the guys he casted, he clearly had a specific type.
Adam, what are your thoughts on all this, sir?
I was looking forward to examining this movie again. Much like Matt, I was not looking forward to watching it because of those specific things. And watching it, so much more jumped out that I just don't have any doubts. It's kind of like watching LA Confidential, where I used to love that movie. And now looking at some allegations and settlements, it's very clear that some people brought themselves and their closeted rapist behavior allegedly and settled into the production. And it's disturbing.
All right. Well, it's inevitable that it's going to come up sporadically throughout the course of this review, because as Matt mentioned, there are parts where I'm also going to talk about it, but I got the majority of it out of the way now because it's dirty laundry, as Matt calls it, and let's just move on with the review.
One of the things we have to talk about, this movie bombed.
Oh yeah, big time.
And it was an outlier because all the other King properties, most of them were making money.
Well, except Shawshank before this didn't, though.
Yeah,
well,
Shawshank didn't do well, but it boosted itself through, like, because you think in hindsight people would talk about this movie given, oh, it's the guy who made X-Men, which was a tremendous success for Fox, but this didn't get that second lease on life that something like Shawshank did. And I think a lot of it was two things. I watched some of the trailers, and also I think just the subject matter. A lot of studios in the late 90s we're talking about, I don't think they were ready to fully tackle this type of material. If this was made in the late 80s, I certainly think there would have been less clenched fists and reservations about doing this. But given we were in the late 90s, you know, Bill Clinton's carefree 90s, as I call them, I don't know if audiences were ready to watch a movie like this.
Also, when you look at it and what we just talked about, you go from a movie about a guy who's a closeted Nazi to a guy who's a closeted homosexual. And when those stories start to come out before the movie's even released, it creates a stigma that it was tough for it to overcome.
That too.
All right, so we open up, we start off with a lecture as Todd, played by Brad Renfro, is just fixated on the word Jews written on the board. We see him flip some pages in historical encyclopedias detailing the Holocaust as the opening credits play. All right, so Todd, played by Brad Renfro, as I mentioned. Now, he was a wide-eyed catch by one Joel Schumacher when he did The Client.
And no acting experience before he made that movie. He was living in a trailer park with his grandmother, and Schumacher wanted a tough kid, because that character in that movie lives a hard life. And I think this goes to show sometimes the benefits of getting an actor who has no fear or, like, pressure, because his first movie is a courtroom drama and he's acting against Susan Sarandon and Tommy Lee Jones. Like, that is not what the position I would want to put myself in as a young aspiring actor, because they are consummate pros and masters of the craft, and he more than holds his own.
I still haven't seen that movie, so he's good in that movie, huh?
He is great, and I've always said Schumacher's best movie. I know that's not a high bar for a lot of people, but he's adapting Grisham, and it's kind of hard to screw that up unless you make The Chamber.
Yeah, I think he's good in that movie. Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into his performance in this then. I have to say that, and I hate talking ill will about the dead, but I don't think he's good here. I don't see a transition. And this may be just because of the way it's written, too. Because, as Matt already mentioned, the book takes place over the course of several years. Here, we have a year to work with. We are going through 1 year. I do not see a different person from the beginning of this movie than at the end of this movie. I don't see
that. You stole my line. No, it's okay. Because, look, we've got a couple shows without arguing. So let me break out the boxing gloves.
Okay.
This, to me, has the problem a lot of people complain about with Kubrick's The Shining, that Jack Torrance is the same guy before he gets to the hotel. In this, Todd is already too far gone. I don't get the sense he's being corrupted by Dusander in the way that I did in the book. Part of that's because of the passage of time. In this one, I know the movie doesn't go this far, but you get the sense he's one bad day away from bringing a gun to school, and it's a Columbine situation. I don't think it's Renfro's fault as much as it is the condensation of time and the way he's already characterized to be really introverted, and clearly he's done his literally done his homework, because another problem I have with this opening, he's already done all the research.
Yeah.
And it's just on the bus he gets the like affirmation in his mind. So I don't like that a story that was subtitled in different seasons, Summer of Corruption, I don't get the sense he was actually corrupted. It's a Jack Torrance thing where he's already, I'll say he's already evil.
He's a shithead in the book too.
No, he certainly is, but mm-hmm. you can sort of attribute that to, like, freshman, because he's, like, 13, 14 when mm-hmm. the book starts. You know, you're still trying to figure out who you are at that age. Here, because he's a senior in high school, you give him less rope. And, again, like, he's already so invested in this to an obsessive level, which is a huge aspect of the novella as well. But here, I don't like that everything is so shorthanded, because it gives me less, not sympathy, but I have no empathy for this kid either, which is a problem I have as well. But I don't think it's Renfro's fault. I think it's the what he's given. And the other question is like, okay, who would you have cast in this role in 98? Because I have an answer.
Go ahead.
He would have been 17 or 18, Heath Ledger. Or is he too pretty? Is he too much of a pretty boy?
Well, Renfro's a pretty boy too.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was on Teen Beat at this.
Yeah, he was.
He was sort of like what Jonathan Brandis. You know, Jonathan Brandis might have been able to do it.
Yeah.
I guess you could have cast Hayden Christensen.
Maybe.
The issue is, he's one note. He's half a Jaws score. He's one note. He doesn't change. There's one scene at the end of this movie where I go, holy shit, he can play more than one thing. I'm actually really irritated hearing how the book went, because, yeah, I do think if you would have had this as somebody's, not even descent into evil, but as to corruption to the dark side, holy crap, this could have been something. But this thing is so truncated. It starts out with him having, this thing starts in such a way that I'm like, did I miss 20 minutes that should have happened before this movie starts? God, no, because this movie's too long as it is for something that, he plays it one way. And I don't think that's his fault, because I think he's fine. In fact, as I said, towards the end of the movie where he's actually plays, he suddenly has a smile and is a little jovial, and I'm like, holy shit, you could have done something. I think he is given one direction, and that'd be just angry and sully. And I feel really creepy that this dude spent the time on set with Singer, because I think it kind of shows in the performance.
Matt mentioned truncated, and it even starts here, because in the book it takes him a set of months to run Deuce Ender down and finally pinpoint exactly where he lives. Here, it's like a weekend where he finds this picture, and there's so many fucking coincidences here. Yeah. It starts driving me nuts.
And he's already got the Epstein file in his in his bedroom, yeah, locked, because he's already got like the fingerprints. Like, he's done all the heavy lifting before the movie's even started. We should see him do some of this like dirty investigative work, because the problem is, like, I already get the sense Deuce Ender already has influence on him, when that's clearly not happened yet. But because of how it's framed and how we're being told and how he's, pardon the pun, done his homework, I feel like I'm missing a step.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand why either. Why does he have this file? Why does he have pictures? Why does he have fingerprints? Why does he is it just because he's some morbid curiosity? Is it for school? Is it for, I mean, look, I went through some very advanced history and government classes where once we had to replay debate at World War II, and a teacher asked if I would be willing to show up in a SS uniform. I swear to God, I was told by my grandparents that I lived with that you will not fucking show up to school that way. But I could understand if it showed some of the reasons he did it. But to him to just show up on this dude's doorstep with all this info because he saw him on a bus, I'm lost. I'm lost, and I'm angered because it doesn't take the time to go through the journey that it should. Singer's just like willing to start by getting waist deep in the pool, not walk into it.
So we see Todd on a bus as someone gets on, and Todd just can't stop staring at him as he'd just seen him in the books that he was reading. We hear a bell ring as the title 1 month later is shown, and he tells his friend that he can't hang out after school because he's busy, his friend being Joshua Jackson, who I forgot was in this fucking movie.
I don't want to wait for this to be over.
So Todd rides his bike to a house and picks up the newspaper in front. He goes to the door, and at first the man inside just wants nothing to do with him, even after he gives him his paper. But Todd asks to be let in, and then gives the dates of Auschwitz and that he was spotted in West Berlin years later. He tells the guy to call the police, as he's sure that they'd be happy to meet him. So this is when we get Deuce Ender, Dinker, Ian McKellen, a relationship that would go on between Singer and McKellen. He would cast him as Magneto a couple years later. While I'm not a huge fan of Renfro in this, I do like what McKellen's doing.
I think he gets good maybe about a third of the way into the film. I don't think anybody is directed well. I think some of the actors bring some good stuff to it, and there's a difference there. But this is the film for me that kind of showcased Ian McClellan to me, and this is an actor that I have loved ever since. I still have a dream to see him on stage one day because he occasionally will do little things, but you can't miss the irony that he plays, you know, a Nazi in this, and then he plays Magneto, you know, just 2 years later. But he is transcendent in this. This is a star-making turn, and based on that, I'm glad he's in it. But it's also, again, he brings what Singer doesn't direct.
He was in a Clive Barker production a couple years before this called Gods and Monsters, which I believe he was nominated for a Academy Award for.
Yeah, he was nominated for Best Actor.
Yeah, so he'd had a little bit of clout before this. Singer got him at the right time.
I mean, come on. Saying Ian McKellen is great in a movie is like saying the sky is blue. So I'm not all that surprised. I'm also not surprised he's far and away the best part of the movie, because I feel like he's doing all the heavy lifting that the script is not giving him the room for. Because he gets some good lines later on, but I feel like this initial like conversation between the two of them, he comes off as way too defensive for me to buy the traversal that happens later on. Because he's very, like, he's being walked over by this kid. He's being very steadfast that, you know, I've lived here. I just think right from inception, the dynamic is not working like it does in the book. And I can't just attribute that to the condensation of time. I needed a little bit more of Todd doing the dirty work to get this guy and answering the why. And also, like, why does he let him in the door to begin with? I wanted a better explanation for that beyond just the newspaper. Now, I do like, the one thing I do like about this, and this is in the novella as well, and unfortunately, this is going to be more of art reflecting reality, the stereotype of the dirty old man who lives across the street, that your parents don't, you know, don't go to that house. And sadly, that's applicable because there's a lot of homoeroticism in their scenes together that border on, if you want to read it as pedophilia, you can certainly look at it from that angle, because a lot of times they're very close to one another. They're almost like an arm's length apart. There's clearly, you know, the fact he spends so much time in an old man's house, war criminal or not. And it's also just weird because you have a closeted gay filmmaker that's making this with his track record and allegations. And then you got Sir Ian McKellen, who's been openly out since the 80s. It's just, you know, it's just sad how it's impossible to talk about this movie without all of the, as I mentioned, not just the dirty laundry, but all the subtext that goes beyond just being subtext because of what we know.
You know what I knew Ian McKellen as before this? Was Death in Last Action Hero.
I was going to say, he did the version of Richard III that came out a few years before.
Yeah, that too. Mm-hmm.
That's such a good, like, that to me shows you can make Shakespeare accessible without changing the language.
True.
That movie's also really good if you want to see, like, a star-studded cast. It's like him, Jim Broadbent, Annette Bening, Maggie Smith, Robert Downey Jr.'s in it. If you think you hate Shakespeare, watch that movie, because Ian McKellen is one of the great, like, Shakespearean actors of all time, which is also why he's as captivating as he is on screen here, because there is sort of some of Shakespeare's work is about corruption, bad people doing things and trying to, you know, get others on their side. So I could see what would attract McKellen to this role. And honestly, I don't think there's anybody else I would have cast at the time.
Same. One thing I want to talk about, and I need to get your guys' opinions on this, because honestly, I was thinking about this all week after I'd watched this movie. And it's a problem I have with the book as well. Nazism is presented as something that innately makes you evil, right? You label as a Nazi, you are evil. But it's a construct, right? It's not something that Dusander is living by. He is an old man just trying to get by in this and in the book. And here this kid is disturbing all of that for no reason, really.
Well, I think the issue is that it's the oversimplification of evil. And I think in turn, when you do that, you come off as disingenuous. I think a key thing about the Nazis that people forget about is that it was a political ideology first that Hitler morphed into targeted genocide. And this movie is not preoccupied with what the consequences of that were and how, because you could do parallels, like, because Dusander would have been clearly a younger man at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way he talks about the stories, he tells them in the way that, like, you would read about them in the history books. You don't get the sense he got a lot of joy out of it or was, like, a willing masochist in that way. So it would have been fascinating to see, like, if he was unintentionally, by feeding this obsession, you're passing it on to the next generation. So my issue is also, you can't confront evil if you don't fully understand it. And I feel like this movie is sort of the Hollywoodization of Nazis, where they just, you know, they killed Jews. That's all they talk about. But on the flip side, that's all people could talk about when you were doing them in movies. Because how many movies with Nazis were either set during World War II or used the Nazis as the villains like the Indiana Jones films did?
I think it's simplistic. I think it works for this and for a couple reasons. We skipped over it at the beginning. I think this is set in 1984 for multiple reasons. One of them is, of course, trying to almost get that allegory to 1984. So that's a little on the nose. But at the time, you still had occasional stories of these Nazis that were hidden, that had fled around the world, and you would get the occasional arrests and death sentences because it was a lifetime mission of some people, including one of McClellan's contemporaries, to go out and hunt Nazis. So I don't have a big problem with him being here, him hiding from it, and that, but it glosses over so many of the other things other than putting on a suit and giving the Sieg Heil immediately almost triggers something back and turns you back into evil because you are, you aren't. And I think that's the problem with Todd shows up evil on a doorstep to an evil man. So what are we doing here? It's just evil begets evil. Evil knows evil. Is he drawn to it? And who's bringing the evil out of who at this point? I mean, obviously Dussender is evil. Is Todd just reawakening that because he's evil? Because Dussender doesn't change Todd.
No, he just magnifies what's already there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is he showing him it's okay because that's what he did?
Especially because the movie also, and we'll talk about this with the ending, one of them pays for their transgressions, the other does not. Mm-hmm. And in the book, while it's a negative ending still, Todd is ultimately killed at the end of the book.
Gets his comeuppance, yeah.
Or at least he gets his, like... So my thought is, like, okay, what is the movie trying to say about... Because a lot of the Nazis got away with their war crimes by fleeing, whereas Todd is going to get by based on what we'll talk about later on. So I just think for a story that's this twisted and is about the perversion of youth, which part of Hitler's political power was indoctrinating youth with the Hitler Youth, like that whole mentality of us against them and
categorizing
people based on appearance, like that. Again, there's a lot more to that whole system, and you know, Adam's a big history guy like me, so I wanted more, but then there's also things that I want less of in this, and one of them is the freaking Brad Renfro just blank staring into the camera.
Yeah. Todd then asked Dussender to let him in. Todd reveals he took pictures of Dussender and even has copies of his fingerprints. Boy, what an advanced fucking kid this kid is.
It's funny that Adam mentioned one of his contemporaries, because I could see Christopher Lee playing this role.
Oh, that's a good call.
Especially at this time, or like a Max von Sydow.
Uh-huh.
But it would have had to be like one of the, like these real high-end actors. Like you couldn't get, I don't know, George Clooney at this time and put him in a Nazi uniform and said, all right, people, action.
I'm kind of sad we didn't see the Nicole Williamson version of this. I think he could have done well too.
Mm-hmm. I love that McClellan was worried that he was not old enough to play this role.
Yeah.
Because he looks at his spot. I don't feel like he's aged though from this point in 30 years either.
Yeah, he was 60. How is it
that he looks older here than he does in the X-Men movies?
Right.
5 years down the road. Like he looks younger in X2 than he does in this.
Yeah, he's 60 here. And he was worried about that. Dussender coughs a little and gets up for a drink. And Todd...
Okay, this movie should have been sponsored by Black Crow Whiskey.
Sponsored by Coke, apparently.
Yeah, because, first of all, that's shitty whiskey.
Yeah, it's like, terrible.
And that's how you know he's a Nazi, because he has no taste in liquor. That's like the cheap shit, you know, like that's like old. I thought it was Old Crow at first, which is part of the, I believe it's part of the Jim Beam line, but no, it's Black Crow, which I had to look up. And I'm like, oh, I've had that once and it tasted like cough medicine. And apparently he's their best customer because he's got fucking bottles of
it. He's got a lot of it.
In his like bread closet. So I'm like, this guy clearly doesn't have taste, because you think the Nazi would have like German wine or... like cognac he would have gotten from Europe. Nope, he's drinking cheap American shit, the blend in.
Todd doesn't want whiskey. He just wants some milk, of course.
I was thinking of freaking, what's his name from Clockwork Orange. I thought that was an intentional...
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's going to be a blatant reference to Clockwork Orange later. Okay, so Dussender says that what Todd has done is a violation and that he is indeed calling the police, but he puts the phone down and says that his name is Denker and he's an American citizen. He calls what Todd has recited lies, but Todd says that he has his fingerprints and photographs, and one way or another, he will get them to the right people. Todd says that he just wants to hear Holocaust stories that his school is afraid to tell. Once he hears
these... Which is also strange because, like, a lot of the history books will go pretty in-depth.
Uh-huh.
if you want to know what went on at these extermination camps. Now, I thought that like they were going to get around this by him being like his library card was restricted, or I know this is 1998, so the internet wasn't really a thing the way we know it now, but I think Dusander goes along with this too easily, and he should have led. There's a device he uses later on to try to turn the tables, but the movie forgets he's that clever for the first third of it.
And don't forget, this takes place in the 80s, too, so the internet still wasn't...
Right, okay, so that gets thrown out the window, mm-hmm. but like the first act of this movie, I feel like he's way too docile and cooperative, considering what we see from him later on and what we read in the book. Like, he's a lot more devious. Well, but I think the problem is also Todd is so like already down the dark side, to Adam's point, that it just feels off.
Well, I also want to mention too that I'm surprised this movie wasn't a hit, just for the simple reason that in the last few years the Holocaust and Nazis were in the zeitgeist again. Don't forget, 5 years before this we had Schindler's List. You know,
when you had American History X come out this year.
And yeah, American History X came out this year. Edward Norton was nominated for that. So the fact that this came out and didn't do shit is kind of surprising to me. Although, given the stories we told beginning this podcast, probably not. Todd says that once he hears these stories, he will leave Dusander alone. Todd says that Dusander should consider this as he hung up the phone. We then see Todd has an A on his paper, but he also has written some Nazi symbols at the top of the page with a little hint of a smile. Adam, you did this a creepy. Lot. I remember looking at your papers. You wrote a lot of Nazi symbols on them.
That's just, man, that...
Yeah, see, I watch a lot of making ofs, and Singer does say that I wanted to stay away from blatantly showing symbols in the movie. You did that like three times in this thing.
Yeah, you showed the swastika multiple times.
We then cut to a month later, as Dusander is now telling stories of the death chambers. He details how the gas came in from vents and ceilings, and that even the children got the brunt of it. He then says that one time the gas didn't work as there was a leak in the pipes, but they were stumbling like drunks. Some fell to their knees yelling high-pitched screams. They didn't die, so Dusander sent in men with rifles after 2 hours. So, Adam, I want to toss this to you. Dusander is reciting these stories. Does it make him evil that he did these? Because he's just doing what he's told, right?
To answer the first question, yes. Yes, it absolutely does. I was following orders. It doesn't mean a thing to me.
and they tried that with Magneto and it didn't work.
I don't think they play that either. Like, I don't think he ever... It doesn't ask us to question if he believes it or not. Did he like it or not? I don't think he feels remorse. I don't think it even... It doesn't belie with those questions, and that's a shame. Because whether he regrets his life or doesn't, Singer's not concerned with that, and that's a failure of storytelling. I do think there should be a point where Todd doesn't want to hear this, and he's like, no, you're going to sit down and hear these stories. And maybe he becomes fascinated by it, especially with the original ending of the book and Dusander's talking about how they had to go in with rifles and kill everybody. There should be an A to B parallel and correlation there, but it doesn't, because you cut that out and you change the story into your own twisted mentality because of yourself. This part where he's telling it is some great acting and some good moments, and it doesn't match up with what could be a fascinating movie.
The problem also, if I'm looking at this from like a suspense perspective, is I never feel like Todd's in any danger when he's with this guy, which mm-hmm. is, I think, something you should have in the back of your mind. Be careful which rabbit hole you fall down, because you won't come back out of it. But also on the flip side, because Todd's done all the research, there's never any ambiguity. What if we as the audience are led to believe that he's just doing this under false pretense? Or, like, he could be wrong. But the movie is never preoccupied with showing ambiguity. It's very black or white, and it's very simplistic.
And also, in the book, Dusander is still evil because he's killing hobos and homeless people on the side. We see him kind of kill one person later. Todd's the one who finishes
it. He attempts one.
Yeah, he attempts one later. But in the book, he's done it a number of times, as has Todd later on when the years start going by. So the fact that he's not doing that is the reason why I'm asking that question. Please don't get the idea that I think Nazism is an innocent thing. It's not. I'm just saying the fact that Singer doesn't show any of that, I'm wondering if that makes him as evil as he is in that book. So Todd then storms out to go to his parents, and on his way, he says that he wants to hear the end of the story tomorrow. We then see Todd fantasizing about what he just heard, even having nightmares. He's face to face with one of the survivors. Again, there's a lot more of this in that book.
Yep. And to address the way this is shot, I find it exploitative and repulsive, for lack of a better word. Look, I have to call this like I see it. And I think this is disgusting how he is drenched in sweat. It's the blue lighting that you'd see in a lot of porn films, for that matter. I think this is like disgustingly exploitative in every capacity, and it makes that I found this really hard to get through.
Same.
And not for the reasons it should. That's the underlying problem with everything we know, is that the movie is supposed to make you uncomfortable, but it's not for the reasons that are intended by the filmmakers.
Isn't that weird? It's the fact that the subject matter should make you uncomfortable already. But given the stigma that surrounds this film, you're absolutely right. Each viewing of this is really, really tough.
Yeah, immensely. You literally take a subject matter that should be so horrifying, but could also be an insightful look into somebody's delve into what happens when you examine evil. And instead, you literally made it about yourself. And that's kind of fucked up. That not kind of a lot. The shower scene, like, I don't just feel bad for him. I feel bad for everybody else that's in here, because I can't imagine what these extras went through to be fucking naked in the shower looking like teenage boys.
Yeah, and we were in high school. That's the other thing that makes it uncomfortable.
Yeah, and we made it. We brought up even when we did Carrie that, like, look, shooting teenage girls was uncomfortable and inappropriate, and this feels salacious. This feels fucking dirty.
Right, and the rationale, at least from De Palma, like, if I'm going to try to justify that, in a lot of ways, it's the linchpin of the movie with her having her period in that context and the humiliation that comes with that. And this, it's just here to be sleazy exploitation, and like, there's no need for them to be, like, bare-ass, which you see multiple times. Mm-hmm. They go the extra mile of, like, shooting when Todd's by himself. They put the camera on top of, like, the balcony, like, where the bleachers are. And Todd's, you only see his behind. Yep. So, like, it's just, I find everything about it just wrong. I think it's, like, the most blunt way I can be with it. And it's unnecessary, because if I'm going to do that, if I'm insistent I have to have, like, a shower scene, you have Todd by himself wearing a towel. And you find stock footage from, like, a documentary, or you just see, like, images of the bodies being dead.
Yeah, you have them walk in with a towel. You don't need to shoot it that low. You don't need that camera angle from the bleachers. You don't need to cut it at the top of his freaking pubis. You can shoot it from the shoulder up and then him see the faces. There's ways to do it without just making it seem like you preyed on young boys.
Plus, there's a lot of nightmares to pull from in that book that doesn't involve this kind of shit. So you don't do this if you don't have other intentions. Todd is woken up by his mom, and it's implied that he masturbated to the images from his dream, and he says that he's just going to go read books to his new friend. His mom.
I also have a problem with the parents being completely oblivious in this.
Oh, yes! No.
Like, yeah. This is one of those things to where clearly there were some compromises that were made in how the story was told, because Todd is the type of early 2000s, late 90s super kid where he works around everything because he knows how to forge signatures. He knows how to hide the report cards. That it makes the parents, they never question him going to the old man across the street multiple times a week for how many months. The guidance counselor never calls to verify the ID when he shows up. Like, this is a world where all the adults are just morons. And it drives me fucking crazy in this movie.
Yeah, in the book, he's like, he's a well-respected athlete. He does have friends.
Yeah, and this, he's got one friend.
Yeah, he has one friend. And
like, and that, like, you could do, like, if you were making him, like, the outcast who's just angry at the world and looking at what, like, wanting to inflict harm on others because you've been harmed. There's something you can mine there to make this more sustainable for a film like this, if not better. But they don't do that. Like, in the parents are such an afterthought that I forgot Bruce Davidson was in this.
Yeah.
It's weird that he shows up in X. He's great in X-Men when he's in that. But I'm like, why are you wasting him?
So Todd's mom, who, by the way, in the book it's implied, is very hot. She says that they still need to meet this guy, Dusander. So we cut to dinner with him and his parents, and we're hearing that baseball is Todd's game, and Dusander thanks Todd's mom for this enchanted evening. He's asked what he did in the war, and Dusander says that he was in the reserves watching hospitals. Todd says he's bored as he's heard all these stories before, and he imagines the stories that Dusander told him, and we cut to him being surrounded by photographs. We keep cutting to the door that Todd imagined in his dream. I do like... See... Okay, can I give a little bit of compliment to the filmmaking here?
There's going to be some nice scenes, I say, because I think you're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
One of the unsung heroes of Bryan Singer's collaborators that I think doesn't get a lot of credit is John Ottman.
Yeah.
Who, not only he's a composer, which is, you know, impressive enough because I like a lot of his work, and I do like the score in this movie to some degree. He's also an editor. And I do think this movie, when it does integrate some of the, like, dream sequences, I think it's well done. But I don't think he gets enough credit for the talent he brings to a lot of these movies.
Todd is still fascinated by these stories, and I think the story is implying that these stories are what makes Todd evil. We cut to a high school PE basketball game where Todd is thrown into a wall. While in the shower, Todd has flashes of being amongst the Nazis and hearing death ordered on the PA. He's then shown being alone in the shower, and we see Dusander being passed out in his chair as Todd stops by with a gift. He wakes Dusander up. He's thinking he's dead, so he walks over to him, and nope, he's just sleeping right on the table, and says that he thought Dusander was dead. We hear that this is Saturday, and he tells Dusander to open his gift. Dusander opens the box and says, "Mary, Mother of God," and asks where he got this. He then reads
and apparently, much like Toy Story, you can just buy this shit and nobody questions it.
Dusander reads the label and Todd tells him to try it on as he thought he would like it. And this is a Nazi uniform. And yes, this was in the book.
Yes. And this is the one scene that's like uncomfortable in a good way.
Agreed. I like this scene.
I think this is actually very effective. And I like that you don't see what's in the, like Seven, you don't see what's in the box until he puts it on later.
I remembered this from the trailer, him in the uniform, him doing the marching. When this is done, I could not remember that it happened so fast. This is pretty much a quarter of the way in. It's only like 30 minutes and he delivers this uniform. Very well done, very well shot. And McClellan plays this wonderfully. So yeah, this is, I don't know if I can call it the high point, but it definitely is to this point.
What I like
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what I like about this scene is that it's kind of the switching of the guard, because Todd is like, and again, it's kind of sickening to kind of see the BDSM qualities of this, but he's ordering him to keep marching as he's marching.
There's some Dom, like BDSM type of.
Definitely.
There's some voyeurism with how he's being gazing at him.
But
like, it's clearly there.
But when he turns about three or four times and he's looking directly at Todd and he raises the arm in the Nazi salute, that kind of freaks Todd out and he's trying to get him to stop, and Dusander won't do it. And this is when the power kind of switches between the two.
Yeah, well, this is kind of the, like, I don't want to say like the rediscovery of who he was, but it's like, it's that tangible connection because he wore that uniform at one time and largely he didn't keep any of his Nazi memorabilia because why would you? But it's almost like this is the moment where he tells him like, okay, I'm going to use this now to my advantage. This is like the one moment of like regret you see from Todd before the switch flips. And this is the kind of stuff that I think is more, like I said, this is tough to watch in a good way. It's edited really well. But like I said, there's clearly some, the dominance aspect in a sexual way is there.
God, I can't wait till we get to Christine. We're just talking about killing cars. So,
well, that movie opens with you know, the equivalent of hiking up a woman's skirt. So I don't know if we're gonna.
Dusander sits down and tells Todd to be careful as he's playing with fire. We then cut to Todd not being able to. All right, so he's not able to get it up with this chick, and he asks her if she wonders why people do the things they do, and she says it's better not to think, and then just blows him in the car. And then she implies that maybe he doesn't like girls. By the way, we're going to be talking about this girl again when we get to X-Men, except it'll be the Roger Corman X-Men, because she plays Jubilee in that.
Yeah, in Generation X.
Generation X, yeah. God damn. Can it be any more overt?
Oh, God, this made me so angry.
Adam, does this make you angry, too?
Yeah. This feels so sleazy. I mean, one, I don't know if he's just pulling from his own experience there, but to be using this in this kind of film, a story in a movie that's already dealing with issues and you're making it about something else, and then you're trying to sleaze it up even worse. At the same time, that I'm just like, you know, what teen doesn't want to fool around is the only reason because he's gay, and that's just so exploitative as it is. I don't get Todd's motivation throughout anything that's really going on, but this seems... Yeah, no, I mean, that's grunt and sigh, the motion picture. I'm disappointed. I mean, Singer's personal shit. He made a great movie before this. He's a better storyteller than this. And I don't know who the fuck he thinks he is that anybody thought this was okay to cram it with this. I don't.
Well, it's also ridiculous because, like, everyone remembers being a teenager when the only thing you could think about is sex. Mm-hmm. Regardless of where you fall on the, like, you know, what you identify as, like, there is a point in your life where that becomes, like, the dominant part of your brain.
If he's not, then I'm sorry, a strong gust of wind gets you hard in the middle of the day. So
yeah, eventually, you know, sometimes you fuck your pillow enough that it turns into a microwave oven when you put your head on it.
Well, speaking of ovens, we cut to Dusander looking at a cat.
I did not do that on purpose.
He did not see my notes ahead of time, but I had to jump.
Oh, you mean
he did not see it?
Not see your notes.
Well done, sir. Well done. We needed some laughs on this podcast. Asking it who he is and says it's getting cold, so he picks him up.
As soon as I forgot, I was like, oh no.
Yeah,
same. Because I couldn't remember if they were about to go as far as I thought they were.
Because in the book, he actually does
it. Stephen King is no stranger to killing cats.
No, he actually does it in the book. Dusander is trying to put the cat in the oven, which it fights and scratches until it gets loose, and Dusander calls it a motherfucker and starts laughing. Now, he does
every morning with his cat.
Please don't get that out there. Now, he does do this in the book. He's successful at doing this in the book. I think it was wise to not let it be successful this time. Adam, as a cat lover, I'm sure you agree.
I think you could have done it without showing it, but I also, this movie, there's no reason to do it because he either is this or he's not. I don't think you kind of reawaken your Nazism.
Yes.
It's like when you forget to take your medication.
Yeah.
It's like the swastika turned upside down.
If he has an electric oven, does it not work on his mental facilities? Yeah. It's just...
Matt, you mentioned that you thought it might go as far as the book. What did you think when it didn't?
I kind of breathed a sigh of relief, and I'm not a cat person, so good on this movie for saving the pussy.
We cut to Todd struggling to finish a test, which he gets a D on before slamming his locker. And then we hear his friend Joey read a letter from the counselor named Edward French, more on him in a bit, as Todd is even missing baskets as he's so distracted. He tells Joey that he'll fix the problem as Joey asks what happened with Becky Trask. And by the way, in the book, he takes this chick's virginity. Again, the fact that you're not playing more years here really hurts this story, along with many other things. Joey then leaves, and this causes Todd to bounce the ball until the bird is completely crushed. Now, in the book, he does this, but he does it with a bike. I don't know. Is the fact that he does it with this basketball at a low angle any better than that?
No, but I like the parallels of them both trying to kill animals. Agreed. In the span of a couple minutes. But I would feel more staying power in that if I felt like these were two characters kind of merging to become one another. But that's not what's being depicted here. And okay, doves just go into a fucking high school?
That was the other question. What's it doing inside this fucking...
Like, is this a John Woo movie where doves just fly where they have no business being?
I can't stand this shit. This is a weird fantasy from the way that it's shot, because it's just, you know, he opens a door and it's got some angelic lighting and all that. But okay, look, if it's telling a different movie, then this makes sense, because you're seeing, you know, kind of like the birth of a serial killer type of thing. And God knows that would be on the nose with the animal, but it would fit. I don't know where this fits and why, other than because we just saw Dusander with the cat, but Todd goes through with it. So is he eclipsed him in evil and is killing an animal, you know, the root of all evil? If so, don't show him the pet cemetery. I don't know.
You also have freaking, like, you're killing a dove, the symbol of peace.
Yeah.
Like, really?
See, I would love this if they took it further and actually did the killing that they did in that book. I know that sounds dark to say, but I think for the sake of this character and where he's supposed to go, I think that was what would make it work for me.
Yeah, it's weird how the movie both goes too far in some extremes and then will pull its punches back faster than Clubber Lang.
We see Dusander reading the letter from Edward French, who guides and counsels, and Todd asks what stinks in there. Todd says that Dusander has a real problem, as the shit he tells Todd just keeps him up at night, and Todd asks if he has another fucking pencil. Why is he being such a dick like this? Why is he saying that the stories you're telling me are giving me nightmares? Like, you're the one who wanted them.
Yeah, now it's like, oh, I can't handle it anymore. I don't buy that for a second.
I don't know. Maybe this is the one thing that he held back on. Maybe this is why he can't get it up and he's angry, but he can't fully tell that story well because he can't tell any of this well. I don't know. He's the one pushing and pushing and pushing.
So Todd says that his parents are going to want to know exactly what happened, and Todd says that he's going to say what happened was Dusander and his ass will go to jail. Dusander pushes Todd out of the way so he can forge the documents that Todd needs. Todd then goes into Edward French's office, and we see that he's played by mustachioed Ross, Davis Schwimmer himself. In the book, this character is 40 years old. In the movie, Schwimmer's 31. He is so miscast in this. He's terrible in this movie.
I don't know what's worse, his acting or that mustache that's being held up there by super glue.
It's so bad.
It is so bad, Henry Cavill would laugh at that mustache.
How many friends are we going to talk about this year?
I feel like he must have just walked over from one of the scenes they filmed on Friends when him and Chandler were in college and he had the mustache. So he just kept it on.
I forgot about those episodes.
Todd's mom is named Monica. Like, this shit. Come on, man. Look, there's times where I think he actually does some good things, David Schwimmer. This is not one of them. No. So in that regard, he fits this movie perfectly because this is crap.
Did Kevin Spacey say no? You think this is the role he would have played?
This would have been tailor-made for him. You're absolutely right.
Well, yeah, because he's accused of being a pedophile.
French says that he wants to get Todd back on track, and he hopes to do it with Dusander's help. Dusander says he arranged the meeting, and French says that this quarter, every single grade is down.
Todd's apparently, you could just walk in and say, I'm someone's grandfather. And
unbelievable. This is in the book, too, by the way.
And people wonder why our academic system is failing.
Yeah, right. French says that Todd's gone from finishing first in class all the way to one of the worst. And he recommends
that's not how grades work. It doesn't happen that quickly.
No shit.
And he goes back to being valedictorian at the end after 2 weeks of studying. Clearly, Brian Singer never went to high school.
French recommends that Todd not go home, but to Dusander's place to study every day after school. He then offers a deal that if he can give French all A's, he can talk to his teachers about discounting midterms. Maybe that's how, but...
You don't get plea deals in high school. Look, what is this nonsense?
So stupid. French then says that he needs to be honest and not forgiving signatures or hiding letters. If Todd continues doing so, he'll show up on his doorstep. French then asks if he can talk to Todd alone for a few minutes, and he says that he understands what Todd's going through as he's going through a divorce. He says that his grandfather thinks he can do this, and so does he, and he gives Todd his home phone number and says to call if you need anything, including girl problems.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I'm not getting into these weeds, but... This is when you go from calling the guidance department to calling child services.
Boy, oh boy.
Does Brian Singer know the difference between a guidance counselor and a principal? Because I'm sorry, the guidance counselor wouldn't have this pull over the teachers.
I know.
What is this? This is clearly Stephen King, because the rules of this don't make sense.
They don't. French says that if Todd gets past this hurdle, the world is going to open up like you won't believe. Todd asked Dusander that if he lost his mind going and posing as his grandfather, and that he could have busted him, but Dusander says that he didn't. Dusander tells Todd that he needs to work and no more stories are in line. Todd says he can pick up the phone, and Dusander says, and do what exactly? Again, I think McKellen's pretty good in this. These are the types of lines I do like the way he delivers them.
I think after like the first third of this movie, I think McClellan gets amazing.
I agree.
You know, he's fine at the beginning. I don't buy the entire beginning of this film, I think is the biggest problem. But I think he's very good for the rest of it.
He says to the whole world he is a monster, and that if he's busted, it will be Todd's name he will repeat over and over. Todd says that they'll never believe him, which Dusander says a scandal like that never goes away. Dusander says,
I want to take a shower myself watching.
I'm telling you. Dusander says he's going to be spending the rest of this quarter and vacation studying. We then see Dusander put on his hat before he hears a noise. He goes to investigate and sees Elias Kateas going through his garbage. He sees that the guy saw him in his uniform and scurries away from the window.
He was looking for a new script to read since they weren't making another Ninja Turtle
movie. I was going to say, he's not with the Turtles anymore.
No, he looks like he just walked off the set of, what was that Denzel Washington? Oh, Fallen?
Oh, yeah.
It looked like he walked off the set of that and just wandered over here.
We cut to Dusander laughing at cartoons as Todd is studying. He's laughing like De Niro in Cape Fear.
Yeah, he's watching, what, Popeye?
Yeah. We're seeing a montage of Todd studying as echoes of the Holocaust and what Dusander's words are dancing in his head. He rides his bike through a tunnel and falls as he spots a Nazi symbol on the ground, and in his head he just hears Dusander say, "It never goes away." We see Todd go through his files and throw them away as Dusander laughs. Dusander sure is in a good mood as he just sings Ode to Joy and grabs some toast. He notices how quiet Todd is and says he's going to give Todd the day off from studying. Todd says he doesn't care about any more stories, but Dusander goes on, saying he will tell the story of an old man who was afraid of a very good student, but he was worse than his mother and his teachers envisioned. This causes distrust between the two, and over time, he felt his hold on the boy was slipping away. He goes on as he's reaching something, and Todd envisions pushing him off the edge. He says that he has rented a safe deposit box, and he has one key that only belongs to him, but in the event that he dies, they would open the box, and the contents of the box would be revealed, that of a 12-page document they would for sure find interesting. Of course, we're going to find out later this is all bullshit. Again, this is straight from the book, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah, that's like... built-in bluff mechanism. Yep. I like this because this is where like reversal has officially happened.
Yeah,
but maybe it's because I've read the book. I never get the sense he actually did this.
I think it was easy enough to make him believe it. I like that the power dynamic appeared to have changed. And I think he could have leaned into it a little more. You know, he could have been the, you know, regardless of what happens to me, I'm near the end of my life. You have your whole life and I'll take it away from you. I think there could have been even more done with this. But so much of this, I'm starting to get bored and bored. I'm just, you know, there's a lot where nothing really happens. It's just Todd studying and okay.
You are absolutely right. This should be a cat and mouse movie that is interesting to watch and be gripping. I am bored to shit as well, and I should not feel that way about these two going at each other like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, this should be like a, I don't know, Kramer versus Kramer level of back and forth and duplicity trying to like outmaneuver one another. And it starts out being one-sided, then it changes to the other extreme. So the scales don't feel fully balanced when you get to the end of things and how they have to condense and contrive a way for Todd to kill somebody.
This unknown bluff causes Todd to lose it, and Dusander tells him to not be so theatrical. He says, "Oh, I wish Winfrey was more theatrical in this, quite honestly."
Yeah.
He says, "Only when he deems the documents no longer mattering, he will destroy them." Dusander says that he senses Todd wanting to kill him, but asks if he could take a life.
You want this, don't you?
Right. He says, to have someone in your control, can you fully understand the power it gives you? Todd says Dusander won't be seeing him around anymore, and Dusander proclaims this to be the end and offers Todd a drink to the end. Todd says Dusander should go fuck himself, and Dusander responds, don't you see, we're fucking each other. This is a line straight from the book, and my God, does it take a different connotation in this, doesn't it, Matt?
Yeah, I almost needed to have my own bottle of scotch while watching to get through this, because it's, and trust me, everyone, I have better shit in my house than this piss water he keeps drinking.
We cut to a baseball game that Todd is playing. He's on the mound and ends up being the hero, striking the last guy out. This is like the only time we get to see him excel at sports, which he does a lot in that book, doesn't he, Matt?
Yeah, and he's like, the movie also forgets what sport he's playing because he's practicing with a basketball.
Yeah.
And then we cut to him playing baseball, even though the movie's already talked about him being a pitcher when they're at dinner initially.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you could have had a similar scene with him killing a bird with a ball.
Yeah, look at Randy Johnson, right?
Yeah, but literally him and Dawson, like they're playing basketball earlier in the film. Yeah. So this is a different movie.
Todd is now doing well in basketball and school too, as some German music is playing in the background. He's even going to the movies with Becky, but it is here where he spots Dusander. We then cut to Dusander on a bus again, as the guy who was digging in his trash earlier spots him. He waves, the bus stops, and Dusander is walking away with his bag in tow as the guy approaches him. By the way, I didn't see this guy get off the bus. He's just here. He tries running Dusander down, saying he can help him. He says he sees Dusander walking down the street, and Dusander tells him to piss off. He says he knows Dusander is a nice guy, and he's ashamed to say that he would like a drink at his place, as well as the use of his shower.
Yes.
We then cut to classical music being played as the guy goes on and on about barking dogs and him being an independent. Dusander says that they need another bottle, so he gets up as the guy keeps talking. He grabs his bottle opener, goes to the window, and offers a toast. They drink up as Dusander rubs his head and then plunges a knife into his back. Okay, so as me and Matt have already mentioned, this plays out a lot in the book in that Dusander kills a lot of these homeless people, and we're going to find out in the book that Todd is doing the same. They don't know that they're paralleling each other, but they are. Adam, would you have liked to have seen, and this sounds terrible to say, but for the sake of this movie and its narrative, would you like to have seen Todd and or Dusander do more of this, kill more people? Because as it is, we only see one die here, and it's by both of them.
I don't think so. I almost think I'd rather see both of them kind of bringing themselves up to it, only because when you get into the blatant homosexual overtones and killing homeless people and everything that goes with that, it would feel even more slimy than so much of this already does. What I wish is that you weren't dumb enough just to stab somebody in the back with a very thin knife when there's a lot of other ways to kill him with a knife when he's not expecting it. This is just like hitting somebody over the head with a pan, not hard enough to kill him. Exactly. Jesus, slit his throat already.
If not committing murder, maybe some more, I don't know what's equally as heinous as murder. There's not a whole lot of things, but so the other problem is that the movie leads you to think he's doing this to cover his tracks because you saw him in the uniform in a scene earlier on through the window. So I thought that was going to come into play and that's why he's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
No, he's just killing him because he wants to. Like, that's not made explicitly clear, so it comes off as very confusing. And again, I'm pretty sure he would have disarmed his memorabilia, but I'm sure he would have kept a Walther P-38 and would have just shot him in the head.
like so much of this movie, it's just happenstance.
Oh, the third act of this movie is terrible. From a writing perspective, it has the three sins. Contrived, it's convenient, and it's convoluted.
Oh, yeah. Let's get to it. So, Jusander punches the homeless guy down and then throws him into the basement. He then grabs a hammer, but stops halfway down the stairs as his heart prevents him from doing anything more. Jusander pulls himself up, and we see Todd receive a call from Jusander, who tells Todd to come over now. Now, in the book, what happens is he's already done the killing. Jusander, I'm talking about. And he's getting ready to bury him. But he has a heart attack in the middle of it. So this is why he calls Todd in the middle of that. Here, he needs Todd to come help kill him. Is this a way to bond them? I'm just so confused at this point.
I guess it's the way to like contrive Todd to come off now as irredeemable. Like this is his, to use a Star Wars reference, this is him disarming Mace Windu, literally and figuratively. Mm. But the way it's done is just so contrived. Like, he locks him in the basement, so maybe he's thinking, I can kill two birds with one stone. That's not made clear. You could have had Jusander, like, lure him in here and turn on the gas so they both die.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure there's other things you could have done to make this better. And look, I know you don't want to have a movie with your, like, lead protagonist killing innocent people, which is why you have Jusander kill the one person in this. But again, even the direction of that is not made clear because of, like I said earlier, with the seeing him in the uniform not coming into play.
I just don't like the way that it's done. I guess that's kind of it. I don't like the way that it's done. If he would have trapped him down here, killed them both, great. If he would have tossed your vagrant halfway into some kind of boiler that was down here but couldn't finish the job, there's something there. The way that this is, it's just half-cocked and doesn't come across as... It doesn't forward anything, really. I mean, Todd's already evil. What does this do? Does he fit it? Meh.
Did you feel this way in 1998? And how was that breakup when you got out of this movie?
I don't remember. I don't ever remember this other than going, well, that's not what I thought I was getting. You know, because it really wasn't. And even watching it for this, I'd forgotten so much because I haven't seen it since then. So it's been almost 30 years. I still don't think I got the movie that sold to us, because this is not a corruption to become evil. This is not a reinvention. This is just plodding along.
Yeah, this is not, you know, because A Simple Plan came out the same year. And I would have liked to have seen the story told like that, where it's people who are desperate and get corrupted by like their own desires coming out. Mm-hmm. I wish we saw something more like that.
Jusander says that he needs help, which means that Todd also needs help. He says that he needs Todd to read an important letter, so Todd heads right over. We cut to him arriving, and Jusander points him to the steps. Todd sees the body and asks what he did, but Jusander ignores him and tells him to go down the steps. As he walks, Jusander locks him in. Todd yells for the door to be opened and yells that he's going to break this goddamn door down. Man, this kid's angry. We see that the guy is now standing, and Todd feels scared. He then starts whacking the guy with a shovel before putting him down for good. And Singer, of course, has caked this set in complete red for this moment. I guess he's looking for some kind of style points with that, but...
Well, there's not a lot to be found, because this movie's largely got a pretty bland color palette.
It sure as hell does.
It's pretty ugly to look at.
And when it does try to get creative, it just falls on its face.
Look, this is the same cinematographer who did Usual Suspects.
Jusander then opens the door and sees what Todd has done as rain falls on the windowsill. Jusander tells Todd to call an ambulance, and Todd insists on getting the key to the safety deposit box.
For the record, this also drives me crazy. This is the longest heart attack I've ever seen.
Yes! We see Todd with his dad, his fucking unassuming father, who has no idea any of this is going on, as they wheel Jusander away, and Todd is told that he saved Jusander's life. Jusander just looks at him as he's wheeled away, and then we see Todd's dad sort of looking around the place as Todd says that they need to make sure Jusander is checked in okay. We then cut to Todd digging the guy's grave and burning him. What an unceremonious way to go. And we then see Todd enter Jusander's hospital room with a gift from his mother, and Jusander says that he now has a new lease on life. Todd closes the curtain and says that he took care of everything and asked for the key, but Jusander says that there was never a safety deposit box. He lied because he had to protect himself from the boy, as he says. Jusander then asks Todd what it felt like to kill someone. As Todd tries to leave, Jusander says maybe he can stay until Jusander falls asleep and his medicine makes him drowsy. We see Todd waking up and walking out as he's stopped by another patient, saying that he must be a very good friend, a German one at that. Todd says he's not sure if Jusander was in the war, and the patient says soon they will have a president who was born after the war was over. He then turns on the Jeffersons as he wakes up and looks over at Jusander. He sits up and takes off his wristband. He goes to Jusander and is shocked at what he sees, and he scurries away as apparently Jusander was one who killed his wife and kid.
I hate how coincidental this is. It's crazy enough that there's already a Nazi in this area. But the fact he shares a hospital bed with someone who was in one of the camps that he was involved in. The odds of this happening are astronomical. The odds for this are about as high as the Jets winning a Super Bowl in my life. You know what? I would believe that first.
I'll give it this before I go to Adam. I completely agree with you, but I like it for one reason. I like it because we are seeing the effect that these assholes have on other people. We're finally seeing it from the perspective of someone other than these two going at one another. The horror of what the Nazis did is finally being felt by someone other than Todd or someone within their camp. So in that, I kind of like it, but you're absolutely right. And the book is like this too, by the way. It's completely coincidental.
Oh yeah, well, because King also struggles with ending. This is one of those things where he clearly had an idea before he had a resolution.
Plus, how more pissed can you get a Nazi by having the Jeffersons on in the same room? The coincidence of that also didn't get lost on me.
Christ, you could win the freaking Powerball Super Lotto twice and still not have the same odds that you would get at the end of this movie. It's coincidental to a fault. At the same time, this actor, this gentleman, and I don't know who he is, he's pretty damn great in what he shows, you know, and the emotions that he goes through. But even if you put two and two together and it's been 50 years, would you recognize him? I guess maybe you would say that you would have to, but this plays so coincidental that it takes me out. But yeah, I don't think that this, to Matt's point, really has an ending. And I say that because there's like 4 points that this movie could end in, like, freaking Return of the King. It doesn't end on any of them.
How many movies like this and Shawshank?
Yeah, Shawshank too.
Have the same problem going. Where they don't know where to end. And I'm curious to know if Stand By Me is going to follow this trend.
But I will say I do like what happens in the hospital. This part of it here and what goes on, it gets me back engaged in the story of what's happening.
Well, now because it's sort of like watching, like, you know, those rise and fall movies. Now you want to see them get their comeuppance. Now yeah. You think this is going to go like the Goodfellas route,
yeah,
where like the lawyer, not the lawyers, but like the law gets involved, and how is Todd going to be able to weasel his way out of this? Will he or won't he? Can he actually? Now that the walls are closing in, you want to see how this plays out. Because for the last 30 minutes, I was bored to tears. In a movie that involved a murder of a homeless man, which if I was going to watch that in 1998, I was going to watch Wishmaster instead.
Jesus.
As you wish.
I'm going to probably try to give the movie a mulligan by saying this. To go on Matt's point, he wouldn't know what he looked like. He might not, but he might know what he sounds like. And maybe it was the voice that tipped him off. But I would like to see some kind of visualization from Singer of him recognizing it or something, instead of just having him walk up and just put his fist in his mouth and say, oh my God, this is him.
Yeah, and not to compare trauma or anything like that. Please don't think I'm making light of anything. When would he have seen this guy vividly enough to like put two and two together? Unless they were going to do the, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die type of thing. Or it was going to be Inglourious Basterds with the opening of that movie where it's clearly vivid. You remember that face because you were so close.
Like, well, yeah.
Context is key and it's not present here.
To that point that he even knows this guy's name and all that when he reports him, it strains credibility for what happens.
Almost as coincidental as it's Kaiser Sose.
I do think Singer believes he's doing that. And I do too. He's not.
Instead of dropping a coffee cup in the hospital bed, he should have dropped like the TV remote. It shatters on the ground.
So the patient hangs on the nurse and cries in her arms as we fade. We then cut to Dusander waking up to agents at his bedside. We hear that the man next to him was a man by the name of Benjamin Kramer, and he was responsible for the deaths of his wife and two daughters. He says that the papers he has won't stand up in court, and the agent says that he can expect to be in Jerusalem by the end of summer.
Now, funny, so Adam says he doesn't recognize the actor that plays the survivor. He's in Last Crusade.
Yes, he's one of the Nazis in Last
Crusade. He is the main Nazi that goes off the side of the ledge with the tank, and he got rolled over. So I find it ironic, again, that we have a Nazi playing a Holocaust survivor before Ian McKellen would do it 2 years later. And I'm shocked. I forgot Joe Morton was in this.
I did too. Talk about underused.
I was like, why wasn't he the guidance counselor?
Right? Oh my God, that would have been perfect. So we cut to Todd's graduation.
Okay. Out of a sitcom with the thing of like French going up to him and be like, oh, nice to meet you. And the way the parents are completely fucking oblivious. They don't ask what he's referring to. Apparently, Todd is like Patty McCormick in The Bad Seed, where he can just talk his way out of any situation. Or maybe this kid is a hidden X-Man because he can control people's minds.
French comes by and congrats Todd on pulling off graduating. He tells his parents that he's Todd's guidance counselor, and French learns that Dusander wasn't indeed Todd's grandfather. Todd says after the ceremony, he'd like to go straight home, and French just looks confused, as Ross always does.
Yeah, like he does the mugging that he did in that show. It's so weird.
We see Todd giving a speech about Icarus, as we see a montage of the agents going through Desander's things until they discover what's in the basement. We then see Todd waking up as a newscast details the body of a Nazi criminal was found.
Okay, so they got a search warrant off of one guy's, who's in a hospital bed.
Apparently.
His word of mouth. Okay, so this is a world where hashtag MeToo does not exist.
The end.
Because apparently people just believe hearsay.
The end of this movie sucks so bad.
We're like seeing the last 20 minutes of this movie should have required like a full. I know you could not have done the way the book ends.
No.
I get that. But another draft would have been beneficial. Because this thing does not know. I feel like the steering wheel has come off of Christine and it's about to crash into an alley.
Well, let's get to the alternative they go with. So we're seeing demonstrations both for and against Desander as Todd and his parents are interviewed by a criminally underused Joe Morton, as I mentioned. Todd says
apparently there's white supremacists in California.
Yes, what was that?
What is this nonsense?
Oh my God.
I mean, even in 84, you really going to have pro-Nazis show up to cheer at a hospital, yeah, man?
There wouldn't be skinheads showing up.
No. Todd says the letter must still be on the table, but it's not there. It seems like they wanted to protect Dusander. Dusander wakes up and Todd's dad comes in to check on him. His dad says that he feels like they let Todd down. Why did you let Todd down? You've let the world down by letting this kid go.
And clearly you guys sucked his parents if he...
Oh my God. And his dad says that they're going to go talk to a lawyer and his old man is going to take care of this.
I would have laughed if it was Susan Sarandon.
Todd says he had no idea who Dusander was. And his dad says, I know. Oh my God. Adam, could you imagine if my dad had discovered I had done something like this? Like, I would still be fucking grounded from this. Like,
oh, you still wouldn't be able to sit down.
No!
You wouldn't either. But I will say, these do feel like waspy parents that are going to protect, but the rest of this town doesn't feel that way.
So you don't see any other adults, basically.
No, there's 10 people in this town, and apparently the one person with melanin comes in to investigate this crime.
Yeah, so much so they had to bring in outside national law enforcement to,
yes.
Again, like, is this the FBI? Because one guy's from Israel, and they're gonna extradite him.
We see Dusander wake up as the agents head to his room. We cut to French showing up at Todd's house. Oh, boy, here we go, guys.
Oh, holy shit.
To see his...
So for the record, this also made me think of the ending of Thinner.
Oh, interesting.
When the doctor shows up to his house at the end, and you know, they made changes in that because in the book, we'll talk about Thinner actually sooner rather than later.
Pretty soon, yeah.
Because that's the same scene happens much like this, but the resolution, the implications are very different.
I was going to say the irony behind that works a lot hell a lot better than what we're about ready to talk about. So okay, guys. So Edward French shows up to Todd's house to see his parents as he shows the newspaper with Dusander's story on it. But then, like, Singer's doing this weird thing where he's cutting back and forth between this and Dusander killing himself by giving himself an air embolism.
Yeah, which is different. In the book, he ODs on medication.
Medication, yeah. Meanwhile, French says that he can't forget about the headline, but Todd says that he wants to go to college and move on with his life. When French says that he's going to do it over the phone, Todd asks if it always works and if this is why his wife left him. And then he says that he's going to put out there that he's playing with little boys. He says he's going to turn him in and make him lose his job if French goes through with this. French says that Todd can't do this, and Todd responds, "You have no idea what I can do," as French walks away. God damn, does this ending suck. I hate this so much. You're going to give this kid power to blackmail the guidance counselor to say that he's doing what the director is accused of doing?
That's the most insidious thing about this, is that this is self-reflective to a level that I almost can't even comprehend how disgusting of a tactic this is. And I can't call this just subtext. You don't make a change this distinctive and make that allegation within the context of a movie if you are not, as the director, trying to build in an excuse for yourself.
You are like, telling on yourself.
Yeah, you are. This is a confessional, and you are basically saying, much like the movie, there's nothing you can do about it because you don't have proof, but all you need is the word is the bond. Oh my God. I'm legitimately, I didn't think I was going to get angry watching this movie, but I did multiple times.
You guys hit it pretty damn on the nose. It reminds me of a politician who makes direct false accusations thinking it's going to deflect when all it does is reflect back on the actual, you're telling on yourself when you make the, so y'all said it. I didn't like it then. Now it's just of all the dirty things in this movie, this made me want to shut it off before I can get the extra 2 minutes to get to the credits. It's that bad.
And also Schwimmer is so bad.
He's so terrible.
He doesn't belong in this.
No, he can't believably play tough or scared. It's like Nicolas Cage in The Wicker Man level of bad.
He's fine as like the nebbish put upon character, but here he's not.
He's trying to be the one who is trying to control the situation exactly. And prevent it from de-escalating, but he comes off as such a pussy.
Now, as disgusting as that pre-ending scene is, the final scene is just plain stupid. So you're going to pan up, show Todd finally make a shot after missing how many times throughout the course of this fucking movie, as German music plays and Dusander is shown dead in bed with the fucking hoop around his head? What are you saying with this? This
is so dumb. You might as well have stopped the movie and had the Vincent Price laugh from Thriller stop on a freeze frame of Renfro walking inside. I can't take this seriously. I don't know what the read is supposed to be. I mean, God, this third act needed to be put out to pasture in the same way that the homeless guy does in this movie and buried in the pet cemetery.
Scale of 1 to 10, boys. What do we give? Apt pupil. Adam, go ahead, sir.
It's amazing that this is the Stephen King movie I decided to go see in theaters when I was a teenager. But I think if you were to give an elevator pitch to what this movie could be, there's a lot of potential there. Unfortunately, what this movie is squanders all of that. The story squanders it. The director squanders it. The actors squander it completely. McClellan is good at parts. Renfro, at the end, there's a part where he comes out and he's kind of smiling and he's laughing. And I'm like, holy shit, he can play more than one tone. So there's potential there. But nothing else in this makes sense. The parents are bad. The story doesn't line up. This movie starts 20 minutes ahead of where it should be because we don't see Todd develop the reasons that he's there looking for Dusander. We don't get Dusander developing. We just get him flipping on a switch. This thing, man, of all the King properties that you do, and there's a lot of bad adaptations, but this doesn't even go into B-movie bad. This is just a bad telling of a story. It's kind of a waste of film. And Singer trying to get ahead of the accusations that would dog him for the rest of his career, in hindsight, feel so uncomfortable that it damns this movie even more, especially with somebody who has been such a champion for the gay movement as Ian McClellan. So it just feels really insulting that way. This thing is not good. It's got a few moments where I'm like, damn, I wish that this was told better. I wish that there was a director who didn't have the baggage to work out his own demons. I wish Renfro was given more to do. I wish McClellan was allowed to direct himself, because there's signs of that. But overall, this thing fails on almost every possible level. It's a 3. I will never watch this again. Well, I guess I'm glad that I watched it here for this, being that it reinforced my need to never watch this again. And so many of these times, I've at least wanted to go back and read the story. This even puts me away from that. I've been looking forward to getting different seasons and reading it. I guess I'm glad I got 2 more, or at least 1 more movie to change my mind, because this has got me off of that book as well. 3 on 10, just a slimy feeling. I need a shower.
You gave last week's movie a 9, so you're not that turned off to this collection of stories.
Maybe I'll read 3 of the 4. Maybe I'll just ignore this one.
Yeah, and this is the longest one, too. Matt?
Well, to give my closing thoughts on this movie, you kind of have to answer the age-old question. Can you separate the art from the artist? It's one of the most challenging debates to do if you are a supporter of the arts in any way. Because you can find any instance where you wrestle with that question. And for me, I always try to do my best to do so. But this movie runs counter to that, because it is the artist trying to self-impose their desires in a negative way that manipulates the art into being something that it should not be. And I say that to say that the art that's actually here, as far as adapting the story, it's not done in an effective context, independent of all the stuff that I find just slimy and repugnant with the production and the person who made it. Because for a story that's about corruption and the loss of innocence in a lot of ways, but you still have that thought of, well, what was this kid already going down a dark path? The movie's not preoccupied with asking those kind of questions or openly confronting the problematic material. It takes a lot of shortcuts. And I think if this was a 30-minute Tales from the Crypt episode, you would have that excuse or at least a wraparound to get around. But with what's depicted here, it's not told very well. And that's before you get to the third act, which not since M. Night Shyamalan have I seen a movie crater to this degree by failing to do an effective wrap-up or get from A to B. Because it forced me to ask the question, what was the point of all this on an artistic level? Because the start and the finish, I don't know what I'm supposed to get out of this. And look, I will give this movie a 4, but that's almost exclusively due to the work that Ian McKellen puts in, because he is one of the greats, and he really elevates material that is beneath him. And I'm not referring to the book. I think the book, there's merit there. But even then, I think King himself couldn't end it properly. So like I said, I know it's hard to separate this entirely, but even divorcing myself to the best of my ability, I can't call this a good movie. So I'm going to give it a 4, and I don't want to see this given another attempt, but I think you can make a very compelling argument that we would be better equipped now to properly tell this story in a way that you're not compromising it, and you're also not self-inserting yourself in a disgusting way.
All right, so you give him a 4?
Yeah, I'm going to land on a 4.
You know, I'm one of those people that I really do like when King goes dark. There are certain stories in his oeuvre that haven't even been adapted. Stuff like Survivor Type, stuff like Crouch End, stuff like The Jaunt. These are all stories that have not been adapted, but I think could work in the right hands. I was surprised at how engaged I was reading Apt Pupil this week in preparation for this review. I do think it is quite the page turner, and I do think the ending, while especially given today's circumstances, is very dark on a lot of levels. I think it's a payoff for how evil Todd is being depicted as getting. I don't think this movie and Bryan Singer know how to depict this kid going evil. I don't think this kid does go evil, and I think this is a movie pulling its punches. On top of that, you have a guy who is following up quite an achievement in The Usual Suspects. That's a movie I've actually watched recently, and it's tremendous the way he can hold that narrative. Now, a lot of that probably has to do with McCurry's script, but I think that movie works on a whole bunch of levels. To follow that movie up with this, on top of just the disgusting nature of the making of it, it's just like the movie is bad quality, the making of it's disgusting. And this script, it is so bad. Matt's absolutely right. The only thing that makes it work for me is the way Ian McKellen is playing this, because I am seeing a guy being put upon in the beginning, get his power back by the middle, and by the end, well, as we've discussed, nothing really works in the end. I have a 4 written down as well. I'm not going to say I was looking forward to revisiting this, but I was looking forward to, after rereading that story and taking notes when I did way back when we were preparing for these things, how this movie measured up to my original thoughts. And the answer, not very well. It's a movie that has so much stigma around it, I would not recommend it more than one viewing. It's bad on a whole bunch of levels, not the least of which is the quality of which it is made. So 4 out of 10 for Apt Pupil. Now, before I preview next week's film, guys, I do want to talk a little bit about what the guy himself, Stephen King, has to say about this adaptation. Now, you have to take this with a grain of salt, because the source is Bryan Singer. He says that King actually enjoyed it. He said he got the tone of what he wrote down pretty well. Now, if you ask the writer of the script of this, he said he always felt bad because he says that he has read things where King has not really praised this movie too much. And by the way, he has not reappraised this since the accusations about Bryan Singer have come out. So who knows what he would think about it now if he would even rewatch it again, honestly. So Adam, not too surprising. He liked it at the time, right?
Yeah, that makes sense for 90s King. You made something of mine. I love it. I think he said that about Thinner as well. So, yeah, of course he did. He's the James Cameron of loving his own shit sometimes.
That's just interesting, given how much they deviated from his ending, that he would say that.
Yeah, well, I mean, King has also been known to not divorce a movie if they change his ending. In fact, we'll be talking about one next year that's kind of notorious for taking an already dark ending and saying, oh yeah, watch this.
Oh God.
I know. And he was very complimentary of that.
Yep.
I guess when you... I don't even think he can keep track of all the adaptations. There's been so many. He's like, did I see that? Oh yeah, that's right, I did. I'm sure he said the same thing about Dreamcatcher when that came out. But he was also hopped up on morphine, so he had an excuse.
Next week, you know, me and Matt had Hulk earlier this year, and both of us have said before the recording of that podcast that we were really looking forward to talking about it because we've never talked about it on these airwaves. I have been waiting for an opportunity to talk about Stand By Me for I don't know how long. And when you add on the layers as to what happened to that filmmaker last year and the things we can talk about next week, it's going to be quite the podcast and maybe the longest in the series. I gotta be honest, I'm really looking forward to revisiting Stand By Me. It played a pretty big part in me getting involved in King and me getting involved in movies in general. So much to discuss with that movie. Matt, what are you expecting when we get to Stand By Me next week?
Well, I was very fortunate that I went to go see this in the theater a couple weeks ago.
Nice.
They premiered it or re-released it for the 40th anniversary. There was a little featurette before they got the actors to come back. Well, three of the four, because sadly Rivers no longer here. But they did like a little expose just talking about the movie, and you know, hearing them talk about it, you can tell that it's still a highlight of their careers and their lives. And that's even removing what happened last year. So I'm curious, because I've never talked about it, but it's also weird because I'm not of the generation that grew up on it. So it's not a hallmark of like that coming of age type of film that it is for like your generation, because for me, mine is stuff that's a little bit later. But I'm curious to watch it, because to be transparent, I wanted to watch anything. I wanted to watch like Gumby after watching At Pupil, to be honest.
You know who did grow up in the era this movie came out and has never seen it? The third on this fucking podcast. I cannot
give him so much shit for this until he dies.
I cannot believe in the years I have known you, I never sat your ass down in my parents' house and watched this fucking movie. Unbelievable. Adam, you're finally getting around to seeing Stand By Me. We're going to review it next week. What the hell are you expecting for this first time viewing?
Isn't this the Goonies prequel? Sequel? No, same universe.
Speaking of the things I'd rather watch than Stand By and then At People.
Oh, God, I can't stand that movie either.
Same here.
Might as well. Whore mouth.
I don't know. Isn't there something about like a leech on a dick? Other than that, I don't know. I'm going to probably compliment Jerry O'Connell for his taste in women later in life. There's a lot of good people in this movie. I'm looking at the cast list. Holy shit. Uh-huh. Like, I'm sure I'm going to enjoy it. Maybe, probably. And I will try to think about what it would have been like if I would have seen this back when I would have been the age that it came out.
But... in my living room? Yeah.
I can't believe your mom and dad didn't make me watch this with you now that I think about it. If they knew, boys, you're not going to play Nightmare for the sixth night in a row. Watch Stand By Me. So we'll see. I'm interested. I don't know if I've seen a movie of Rob Reiner's that I can say, I wish I didn't watch it. So that gives me about as much hope as anything.
So you've never seen North?
Nope.
And you never saw the one with Kevin Costner and Michelle Pfeiffer?
What the hell is the name of that movie?
Garrett, you help me out.
I don't remember. I don't know. Adam, what about Misery? You've seen Misery, right?
Of course I've seen Misery.
Of course you've seen Misery. Jesus Christ.
He's married. Of course he has.
I've seen Misery. I saw Fitter in a movie theater, God damn it.
With me.
Yep.
Do you have
a movie? I'm thinking of The Story of Us. It was Bruce Willis, not...
Oh, yeah.
Oof. Okay, you know what? I might as well tell it here because we're never going to tell that. Laura and I rented that movie when we were dating.
Oh, shit. Nice move, Adam.
She's really still married nice move. Me. And I gotta say, I'm sorry. I like that movie.
Why don't you just follow that up with, I took her to At Pupil.
Yeah, no, yeah, I took her to
Kevin Costner because he also made Rumor Has It, which is also god awful.
That's no, terrible.
I took Laura to see The Human Stain in movie theaters.
I remember you telling me that story.
How is she still married to you? <I don't know. laughs>
Well, I got one reason, but...
Hope a leech doesn't get a hold of that. But until next week, when we get to Stand By Me, be careful. You're podcasting with fire. Thank you, boys.
forget that there are places in the world that aren't made out of stone, that there's something inside that they can't get to, that they can't touch. It's yours.
What are you talking about?
Hope.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
And for the briefest of moments, every last man at Shawshank felt free.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
And still, it wasn't enough for Himmler.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net. as we have tons of franchise reviews, such as the Alien film series, the films featuring the team-up of Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Megan films, the Black Phone films, and so much more.
Pleased to see you reading this.
And if you would like to follow Garrett as he reads and review Stephen King's books in publication order, find and friend his profile on the Goodreads app.
If you ever get out of here, do me a favor.
Sure, it. Anything.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Boy, be careful. You play with fire.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
I'm not ashamed to say that I could use a drink about now.
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
A little hobby of mine.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Like that, I could use a man that knows how to get things.
Scheduling done by Matt.
We've been friends a long time, so I know him as good as anybody.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I think I just turned my Fruit of the Looms into a fudge factory.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production, copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Skin it. See ya. Not if I see you first.
He he is great, and I've always said Schumacher's best movie. I know that's not a high bar for a lot of people, but he's adapting Grisham, and it's kind of hard to screw that up unless you make The Chamber.
Especially in the 90s. Adam, do you feel the same about Brad Renfro?
Sorry. I watched The Chamber in theaters. That joke just got me. I think he's...
But also, on the flip side, because Brad's... I keep saying Brad. Because Todd's done all the research.
We cut to a high school PE basketball game where Todd is thrown into a wall. And we have the high school shower scene we just mentioned. Not going to talk about that. Oh, I even have a male version of Carrie written down here, Adam. So good call there. While in the shower, Todd has flashes of being amongst...
Regardless of where you fall on the, what you identify as, there is a point in your life where that becomes, the dominant part of your brain, that in your impulse. I was about to tell a story, but I don't want to get too personal.
if he's not...
Yeah, it's weird how the movie both goes too far in some extremes, and then will pull its punches back faster than Clubber Lang after seeing... Adrian on a strip pole.
Wow. You couldn't save that for another retrospective or two? You had to use it now?
No, I'm trying to do some foreshadowing of things to come.
Okay. We see...
Look, this is the same cinematographer who did Usual Suspects.
Uh-huh.
Fallen, yeah. Ironically.
Do you send her then?
And my favorite, Blank Man.
Did he do Blank Man?
I legitimately like that movie.
I haven't seen it since theaters, and yes, I saw that in theaters.
No, we're not doing that as a retro, everyone. Shut the fuck up.
No, if you're listening to this, you're going through the bloopers. You're not going to get it. Do Sandra then open? We see Todd giving a commencement speech about Icarus. Thank you.
Icarus.
We see Todd giving a speech about Icarus.
God, this third act needed to be put out to pasture in the same way that the homeless guy does in this movie and buried in the pet cemetery.
Oof. Boy, do I wish we were talking about that.
I don't know. We'll see if you're saying that when we get to Pet Cemetery 2.
That's true.
Remember, there's not just one movie. We're going to watch four in that series.
You're right. Adam, how do you feel? There's one and two, and then the remake, and then the prequel.
The prequel to the remake.
Yep.
Well, give me a tube to blow into.
Blood out of David Carradine.
scale of one that. Do you have?
Oh, I'm thinking of The Story of Us. It was Bruce Willis, not.
Oh yeah.
Oof. Okay, you know what? I might as well tell it here because we're never going to tell that. Laura and I rented that movie when we were dating.
Oh shit! Nice move, Adam.
She's really married nice move. Me, and I gotta say. I'm sorry. I like that movie.
Why don't you just follow that up with, I took her to App Pupil.
Kevin Costner because he also made Rumor Has It, which is also god awful.
That's I took Laura
to see The Human Stain in movie theaters.
I remember you telling me that story.
How is she still married to you?
<Don't know. laughs> Well, I got one reason, but...
I hope a leech doesn't get a hold of that. But until next week, when we get to Stand By Me, be careful. You're podcasting with fire. Thank you, boys. Okay, time to take a fucking shower. Jesus Christ.
We finished with a laugh.
Yeah.